I've been thinking about the question first posed by Hannah Pitkin some decades ago in a book called Wittgenstein and Justice. She asked then, what, if anything, Wittgenstein might have to contribute to our understanding of ourselves as political beings? Pitkin realized that her question would have no easy answer, since Wittgenstein speaks nowhere, hardly anywhere at least, about politics in his strictly philosophical work, and his occasional asides on the topic are, to my mind at least, entirely inconclusive. I believe not much mileage is to be got out of thinking about Wittgenstein as a conservative thinker. This leads nowhere. It is true, of course, that Wittgenstein thought deeply on ethical questions, as the end of the Tractatus and the lecture on ethics make evident, and one might expect there to be some kind of bridge from his ethical concerns to politics. But Wittgenstein's ethics is in fact singularly apolitical in character. One can even call it anti-political, to use Nietzsche's term for an actual aversion to politics. In conversation with Russell, Wittgenstein provoked the politically minded mentor with a biblical word, "What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" And saving one's own soul, he said to Russell, turning now the knife in the wound, depended more on suffering and the power to bear it than on any positive action. He was overwhelmed at the time by a quietist and thoroughly apolitical sentiment voiced by a character in a popular Austrian play, you have heard, all heard about this, who felt that no matter what happened in the world, nothing bad would happen to him. That thought was in fact who sustained Wittgenstein during the battles of the First World War, and 10 years after the war, he spoke of it still in his lecture on ethics as a paradigm of the ethical view of the world. In the Tractatus, in the meantime, he had written of the will's inability to alter the facts, its capacity only for giving the world as a whole a positive or negative meaning. The ultimate ethical goal, he had concluded, was not intervention in the world in order to make it a different place, but, quote, to see the world aright. Later on, in 1931, he remarked in a kindred spirit, I quote again, that work in philosophy is really predominantly a working on oneself, on one's own understanding, Auffassung, on how one sees things and what one demands from them. This deeply personal, one might even call it visionary form of ethics, appears to have little to do with social engagement and political action, with any desire to change the world. I agree nonetheless with Pitkin that Wittgenstein has lessons to teach us when we set out to think about political matters. Those are to be found, however, not in any concrete positive political views that Wittgenstein may have entertained, but in his thoughts on the diversity of language games and world pictures, on the multiple uses of language and the variability of what we call meaning, on the resemblance structure of our concepts, on the web of family resemblances that social concepts in particular exemplify, on the grounding of rules in regularity and practice, on the unsurveyability of the human form of life and the interconnectedness of the private and the public. Even Wittgenstein's visionary conception of ethics, I want to say, may be of interest in this context by suggesting a corresponding possibility of a new visionary kind of politics. Most relevant, perhaps, is Wittgenstein's insistence on the need to examine our most elementary philosophical concepts, those of philosophy, for instance, or language, or meaning, since it motivates, this insistence motivates, I think, the complementary lesson that we must equally attend to our elementary political concepts, those of politics, power, conflict, decision, deliberation, as well as, of course, of democracy, justice, liberty, equality, and so on, if we are to avoid the trap of ever more elaborate and ever more confused theorizing. A further thought, maybe the last on this line, is that political insight may be gained even from Wittgenstein's anti-political stance. As political theorists and philosophers, we tend to consider only those with a positive interest in the matter. statesmen, legislators, professional politicians, political organizers, activists, commentators, and analysts. It never occurs to us that however much they differ, they may be sharing a one-sided view of our political reality. The acknowledgement of A and anti-political individuals and of A and anti-political forms of thought throws thus a distinctive light on this reality. It highlights that being political is just one among various forms of human life. Eduard Spranger, from whom Wittgenstein most likely took the term Lebensform, recognized this in a book called Lebensformen, when he spoke of political man, the man of power, as instantiating only one possible form of human life. Politics may appear all-consuming at all bad times, and according to the politically engaged calls on us constantly and persistently, but the anti-political individual evades its supposed demand in the name of holiness or personal perfection or of science, art, philosophy, or simply the wish for a quiet life. The presence of such individuals forces upon us the thought that Aristotle may have been wrong when he called us political by nature. But the politically engaged will no doubt say that apolitical individuals still find themselves in a political world, though perhaps without recognizing the validity of its demands. Was Wittgenstein not forced into war by circumstances beyond his control, and later to become a British subject, again by circumstances out of his control? Still, does the existence of anti-political individuals not allow us to conceive at least of the possibility of humanity freed from politics? That is surely the great anarchist hope. But with this possibility, we face the question what contingent historical forces may have been responsible for the emergence of politics, what deeds, real or imagined, politics serves, and to what extent politics may be a historical, but an entirely contingent human achievement, or alternatively, an equally contingent human burden. My concern today is, however, not with these questions, but with a related one. The question, what, if anything, Wittgenstein may have to contribute to our understanding of ourselves as historical beings. I will not even try to sort out the complex relations of politics and history here. My assumption is simply that in order to think politically, we must think of ourselves in terms of past, present, and future. For all forms of politics, temporal categories are important, and for most forms of politics, historical ones as well. But now it may seem that we are confronted with a similar difficulty to the ones we faced when asking about Wittgenstein and politics. Wittgenstein certainly does not speak of historical matters in his major writings. He doesn't, for instance, examine the history of philosophy or look at other philosophers as historical figures. But a closer look, we also notice some differences. His conversations and notebooks, entries, reveal historical interests. And his notes on Spengler's Decline of the West and on Fraser's Golden Bough show him to be grappling with some meta-historical questions. Most importantly, the course of his thinking seems to have taken him from a strictly anti-historical point of view to one that approaches a historical relativism. The question of Wittgenstein's thought on these matters is of interest to me, among other things, because our engagement with Wittgenstein himself has turned so historical in recent decades. We have learned increasingly to look at Wittgenstein's writings in a historical or even historicist spirit. Brian McGuinness, Ray Monk, and others have argued for the bearing of Wittgenstein's biography on the interpretation of his work. We engage in this line of work, and I include myself very much in all this, moreover, not as historians of ideas, but see ourselves still committed to Wittgenstein's way of thinking. Is it possible that we have slipped into a very different, un-Wittgensteinian form of thought, a hermeneutic, historicist sort of philosophizing that is worlds apart from Wittgenstein? Can one genuinely be a Wittgensteinian historicist? And what would such a figure look like? To explore these questions, I turn first to Wittgenstein's most resolutely anti-historicist moment, then to a time when history and time, when time and history become a theme for him, and finally to the late period when a more historically minded thinking manifests itself in his writings. So the rest of the paper is divided into three parts. Then the first part is called, the new part is called Subspecie Aeternae. The anti-historicist strand in Wittgenstein's thinking expresses itself most forcefully in a notebook remark from 1916 that reads, "What has history to do with me? Mine is the first and only world." It's such a remarkable sentence, right? What has history to do with me? Mine is the first and only world. Those sentences did not make it into the Tractatus. But this does not imply that Wittgenstein had changed his mind on the sentiment they expressed. He was, on the contrary, just as staunchly an anti-historical in the Tractatus as he had been 2 years earlier. While the book speaks in its highly condensed fashion of all kinds of matters, from the structure of the world to the meaning of life, it has nothing whatever to say about the historical dimension of human existence. The word history makes, indeed, no appearance in the Tractatus. And even the notion of time is mentioned only in passing. We get a vivid impression of Wittgenstein's anti-historicism from the first two sentences of the Tractatus, which say that the world is everything that is the case, and the world is the totality of facts. The is in them is evidently the same timeless, non-temporal is as in the mathematical proposition that 2 is a prime number. The facts of the Tractatus are timeless, even when they involve temporal events. And our sentences are also, once again, timelessly true or false. Time and history do not enter into these considerations. It does not matter here that the Tractatus ultimately rejects this entire set of claims as nonsensical, for even that rejection is cast in ahistorical terms. The only thing we can say is that the Tractatus implicitly tells a temporal, although quite ahistorical story, when it concludes, "One must throw away these propositions, then one sees the world aright." But this temporal moment is so little thematized in the text that it has escaped almost all readers of the Tractatus. I turn back then to Wittgenstein's anti-historicist remark from 1916 in order to consider what exactly he may have meant by it. And here it is useful to separate the personal from the philosophical. Wittgenstein had begun his notebook on August 9th of 1914, within days of the outbreak of the First World War, freshly enlisted as a soldier in the Austrian army. It was meant to signal, first of all, his determination to continue, even in his new soldierly existence, the philosophical work he had been doing in the previous few years, to continue above all, in his own mind, the intricate and heated conversations he had had with Bertrand Russell, his mentor, friend, and intellectual other, from whom he was separated now as an enemy alien. The early pages of the notebook show him indeed to be reviewing issues and questions he had been mulling over with Russell long before anyone had ever contemplated the coming of war. We might thus read the 1916 remark initially as an expression of Wittgenstein's determination not to be diverted from his philosophical work by the large course of history that had swept him up. But when Wittgenstein wrote those two extraordinary sentences, he was in fact in a wholly different state of mind from the one he had been in at the beginning of the war. He had passed through the hellfire of battle and had been left convinced that he would never survive the war. As a result, he was also seeing his philosophical work now in a new light. His purpose was no longer to continue Russell's work. He was grappling instead now with the most fundamental questions of life. Another possible meaning emerges thus from the 1916 remark, the thought that Wittgenstein was distancing himself in it from his own past, from Russell and his projects, and indeed from the entire history of philosophy, and that he saw himself left to philosophy now entirely out of his own resources. Or should we interpret his words, a third possibility, even more existentially, as an expression of Wittgenstein's certainty that he would not survive for long, and that what counted now was not history, but the moment? Was he saying, in the midst of a great historical upheaval that the world had contracted for him to this moment, to this one experience that was now his own. We can perhaps hear echoes of such a thought in the Tractatus, where we read that eternal life belongs to those who live in the present. There is danger in reducing Wittgenstein's remark to an autobiographical footnote. Does it not also carry philosophical weight? Once again, we need to ask to what moment his words refer us. The answer might be, for instance, to Wittgenstein's pre-war years at Cambridge, when Russell had been committed to his logically simple objects and to the doctrine that apart from the immediate objects of experience, everything else was a logical construction. Thus, a historical figure like Bismarck, the German Chancellor, so Russell later in the philosophy of logical atomism, had to be considered a logical fiction. And presumably the same had to be said about history as a whole. Is it possible then that Wittgenstein was speaking of this view when he wrote, "What has history to do with me?" Some interpreters have indeed sought to read Wittgenstein as a sense data theorist, and this might explain those 1916 words. I doubt, however, that this reading is correct. But this still leaves the possibility that Wittgenstein's remark may have been meant not as expressing a view he would endorse, but as a reflection on sense data metaphysics, as expressing the realization that for the sense data theorist there is no history, that the only world there is for such a thinker is his own. Wittgenstein certainly understood this to be a temptic philosophical view, for in his philosophical remarks, he noted in 1930, we as philosophers, are tempted to say only the experience of the present moment is real, has reality. And this, quote, appears to contain the last consequence of solipsism. For the solipsist will be drawn to saying, quote, a proposition like Julius Caesar crossed the Alps merely describes my present state of mind. But when Wittgenstein wrote this in 1930, he was clear that this way of talking must be rejected, since the proposition does evidently not describe a present state of mind, but, quote, an event we believe happened circa 2,000 years ago. It's also possible that Wittgenstein's words refer us to views on logic which he may have shared with Russell during the pre-First World War period. In notes written for Russell in 1913, he had argued that philosophy consists of metaphysics and logic, or metaphysics that is based on logic. And in tune with Russell, indeed the tradition, Wittgenstein had conceived of logic as something timeless, sublime, and indeed ahistorical. We might read the 1916 remark then also as a declaration of the sublimity of logic. This is an old thought from the beginning of Greek philosophy. In its name, Parmenides had argued that temporal change, and a fortiori history of course, is impossible since what is, quote, is now all at once, one, and continuous. Wittgenstein's picture of logic may also have been derived to some extent from Frege's, who had argued forcefully that logic is concerned with timeless truths. The proposition that it is sunny today, written in Berkeley, of course, which appears to be variable in its truth value, is only shorthand for the timelessly true proposition that on April 12th, 2013, it is sunny in Berkeley, California. Time is thus only a parameter in timelessly true propositions. Wittgenstein's 1916 remark may be understood still more broadly to be saying that the properly philosophical way to look at the world is not from a historical point of view, but sub specie aeternitatis. This reading appears to be confirmed by another entry in the 1916 notebook, which declares, quote, the usual way of looking at things, that is the non-philosophical view, of course, sees matters as it were from the midst of them. The good life is the world seen sub specie aeternitatis. The phrase, we have been told in Latin, is originally Spinoza's. But Wittgenstein is likely to have borrowed it from Schopenhauer's treatise, The World as Will and Representation. Schopenhauer argues there, extending a line of Kantian thought, that time is merely a form of intuition and not metaphysically real. He then went on to quote Spinoza as saying, the mind is eternal insofar as it conceives things substantia eternitatis. And to this Schopenhauer added, quote, the individual as such knows only particular things. The pure subject of knowledge knows only ideas. The pure subject of knowledge and its correlate, the idea, have passed out of all forms of the principle of sufficient reason. Time, place, the individual that knows and the individual that is known have no meaning for them. Time has no meaning for the true metaphysical subject. He went on to speak of the timeless and deep view of things as being also that of the mystics. All this, of course, chimes with Wittgenstein's words in the Tractatus. To view the world sub specie eterni is to view it as a bounded whole. Feeling the world as a bounded whole, it is this that is the mystical. We may ask then whether it is this thought that he wished to express in the proposition, in the question, what is he going to do? Wittgenstein's words may also be understood as characteristic of that movement, of that broad movement we know as high modernism. His whole book can indeed be seen in this way. The sparseness of its prose, its conceptual austerity, its minimalism, its deliberate avoidance of classical models and historical references, and most of all, in his singular preoccupation with the notions of structure and form, it may be thought of as the philosophical equivalent of Malevich's suprematism, Mondrian's calibrated grids, and Bauhaus architecture. Like them, a document of a moment in 20th century culture that is still close to us and yet no longer quite our own. Hence, that mixed feeling of familiarity and strangeness that strikes us when we read the Tractatus today, similar to the ambivalence that overcomes us in the face of a Mondrian canvas or a Bauhaus construction. The link between the Tractatus and these other expressions of high modernism is made, of course, explicit in Wittgenstein's house, which one of his sisters rightly called not a human habitation, but logic turned into architectonic form. With Malevich, Mondrian, Kandinsky, and other high modernists, the Wittgenstein of the Tractatus shares moreover a distinctive turn towards the spiritual and the mystical. Attention to the pure forms of logic, to the structures of mathematics, and the clear lines of geometry provides these modernists with the only clue to the spiritual they will recognize. For all of them, the concern with form, far from being the expression of a positivistic scientism, is meant to give access to a new kind of spirituality, cleansed of all the historical associations of traditional religion and other belief systems. Measuring time. Wittgenstein's thinking was to undergo profound change in the late 20s and early 30s. That's true, whatever view we take of the continuity of his thought. One signal of such a change was his new concern with time and the philosophical Marx and the philosophical grammar, and another, a new interest in history that is made explicit in his notes on the works of Spengler and Fraser. In the philosophical remarks, Wittgenstein speaks of two concepts of time, physical time and experiential time. In physical time, all moments are equally present as in a film strip. In experiential time, we are by contrast always in the present as in the movie theater when we see only the presently projected image. He writes, quote, if I compare the facts of immediate experience with the pictures on the screen, and the facts of physics with pictures in the film strip, on the film strip there is a present picture and past and future pictures, but on the screen there is only the present. And here it is important to note that the is in the proposition that on the film strip there is a present picture is once again the timeless is, whereas in the proposition but on the screen there is only the present, we find the tensed is. Wittgenstein flirts in the philosophical remarks even with the idea that we might have two kinds of languages at our disposal, a physical and a phenomenological language, in which we speak by time in these two different ways. But he finds this ultimately unviable and concludes, I do not now have phenomenological language in mind as my goal. Nonetheless, there remains for him the possibility of speaking about both physical and experiential time. In experiential time, we find ourselves immersed, quote, in the stream of life or the stream of the world, but always only at the present moment. In experiential time, there is then, in a sense, no history, only an ever-changing present. And in physical time, there is a past, a present, and a future, but only as something static. The stream of life, the stream of history, is there all at once, but fixed and frozen. These considerations connect Wittgenstein's simultaneous, connect to Wittgenstein's simultaneous interest in the 11th book of Augustine's Confessions. The Blue Book expresses sympathy for Augustine's puzzlement over the nature of time. No wonder that time is puzzling, because it presents itself to us with two quite different faces. Wittgenstein is also intrigued with Augustine's question how it is possible to measure time since only the present moment is real. Admittedly, he rejects Augustine's solution according to which we can measure the passing of time only in our minds, by experiencing that passing of time. He adopts instead a view Augustine rejects, namely that we measure time by comparing its passing to another process, such as the movements of a clock. Augustine is right in thinking that we can't measure time in the way we measure other magnitudes. A table is present all at once, and we measure its length by laying a measuring rod alongside it. The image of time being measured the same way is misleading. In physical time, we can say that past, present, and future are equally present, but in experiential time, only the present is there, and its passing can therefore not be measured in the way we determine the spatial length. But if experiential time gives us only always a passing present, can we then have an experiential knowledge of history? Wittgenstein holds that history is available to us only in memory. But this memory is not a seeing into the past, a point that Russell had already made in 1922 in The Analysis of Mind. This raises a question, quote, how do we know at all that it, that is memory, is to be taken as referring to the past? So I have this image of something, right? And how do I know that it's a memory that it refers to something in the past? Have we, say, learned from experience to interpret these pictures as pictures of the past? Clearly it must be. Right. Compared to Heidegger's contemporaneous reflections on authentic temporality and historicality, these considerations seem, however, narrow and cramped. Wittgenstein lacks, it seems, any appreciation of the fact understood by Heidegger that our experience of the present is not of an atomic unextended moment, but of something directed always both forwards and backwards. It's not simply that at every moment I also entertain in memory propositions about the past in addition to having my experience of the present, but that my present experience is typically saturated through and through with the past and at the same time intentionally directed forwards into the future. And so now I want to suggest to you an experiment, which we'll do right here now. So I want you to kind of focus on the experience of the present moment. I will give you a sign here. I will raise my finger and I'll say now, right? And then you will experience that moment and you will ask yourself, how do you experience that moment? Can you experience that moment separate from the present, past, and the future? Right? What are you experiencing? So, now. I leave it to you what you experience. Yeah. I want to say that the experience of a bare present, this is what Wittgenstein is thinking about, is achievable. I'm not saying it's impossible, it's achievable if at all only through a rigorous process of abstractive thinking. You have to be a philosopher to force yourself in seeing the present as present or as a limited experience. For instance, when you are faced with death, in war, maybe then you can have that experience of the moment as being the only thing that is real. None of this is realized, however, by Wittgenstein in the 1930s. He doesn't admit explicit that he may well have come to feel the insufficiency of his reflections on time, given that he did not later return to them. There is, however, one observation and philosophical remarks that resonates with his later thought, and that is the idea that, quote, language unwinds in time. He adds to this that, quote, that everything flows must be expressed in the application of language. an effect not in one kind of application as opposed to another, but in the application, in anything we could ever call the application of language. For all uses of language, all application of language is an unwinding of language in time. With this idea, Wittgenstein seems to me to have moved decisively beyond the timeless picture of language of the Tratatus, where the Tratatus had conceived a language as a formal structure designed to map the equally formal structure of the world. Wittgenstein found himself induced now to think about such activities as, you know, formal investigations, giving orders and obeying them, making up stories, meeting, and so on and so on. And then he looked from this new perspective at the question how signs and sentences had meaning. The insufficiency of the formal account of meaning of the Tractatus struck home to him. Meaning could certainly not be reduced to a mapping relation between two formal structures. Instead, quote, when he said this form, the blue book has already come up. If we had to name anything which is the life of the sign, we should have to say that it was its use. And there is a passage, I haven't quoted this here, in the investigations where he says that use is something extended in time. Right? The timeless picture of language of the Tractatus was thus replaced by one in which time figures essentially. The process of learning, the composition of exchanges, and in the embedding of language in non-linguistic activities. Meaning is use, then the meaning of our words has an inherently temporal dimension. The first section of the investigations illustrates the point paradigmatically. Quote, I send someone shopping. I give him a slip marked 5 red apples. He takes the slip to the shopkeeper, who opens the drawer marked apples. Then he looks up the word red in the table and finds a color sample opposite. Then he says the series of cardinal numbers up to the word 5, and for each number he takes an apple of the same color as the sample out of the drawer. The story involves, in fact, 8 distinct steps, 8 different moments in time. The explanation of how the words 5 red apples have meaning for us has become temporalized. But to recognize the temporal dimension of language, the meaning is not the same as taking a historical view of human life. When we read Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations, we are struck by his continuing lack of attention to language as a historical phenomenon. The language games he considers are for the most part abstract and almost always invented, not samples of actual, historically actualized uses of language. Wittgenstein strives to give, he says, a natural history of language, of commanding, questioning, recounting, chatting, and of other such uses of language, but he is ready, quote, to invent fictional natural history. The remark testifies to Wittgenstein's continually abstract view of language. What is more, the term natural history has in this context no temporal connotations. Instead of natural history, Wittgenstein could also have said phenomenology. Wittgenstein never became a historical writer in the same way some of us are, who nevertheless who seek to extend his lines of thinking. He became neither a historian of philosophy, nor a dedicated philosopher of history, nor did he set out to reflect on language as a historical reality. What would he have thought of our endeavor to see him as a historical figure and to see his work as a response to a historical moment? Admittedly, we can't ignore his fascination with Spengler's Decline of the West and the historical and meta-historical issues it raises. But what exactly did he take from Spengler? I conjecture that it was due to Spengler that he would later on write of world pictures as giving our individual acts and utterances their meaning. Spengler had spoken of the possession of such a world picture as a unique cultural achievement, something far from being fixed and universal. He had talked of children and, quote, primitive man as lacking as yet any such thing. Only advanced cultures, he had declared, possess a concept of world and are therefore capable of constructing a coherent world picture out of the mass of their heterogeneous knowledge. The resulting world picture manifests itself in a culture's, quote, visible, tangible, and comprehensible expressions, acts and opinions, religion and state, art and science, peoples and cities, economic and social forms, speech, laws, customs, characters, facial lines, and costumes, end of quote. Wittgenstein may have been particularly struck by Spengler's observation that, quote, one condition for this higher world consciousness is the possession of language, meaning thereby not mere human utterance, but an encultured language, Kultursprache. Non-historical man, so Spengler has only a scattered set of beliefs. The possession of a single coherent picture of the world is, however, according to Spengler, only one precondition for a historical form of existence. The world picture of historical man will be more specifically one in which the world is seen as becoming, not as become. That is, as dynamic rather than a static or even timeless reality. Spengler writes, quote, historical man, as I understand the word, is the man of a culture that is in full march towards self-fulfillment. Before this, after this, outside this, man is historyless. From this there follows a fact of the most decisive importance, and one that has never before been established. That man is not only historyless before the birth of culture, but again, becomes so as soon as civilization has burned itself out fully to the definitive form which betokens the end of the living development of the culture and the exhaustion of the last potentialities of its significant existence. According to Spengler, the West has now reached the rigid state of civilization, a state in which the belief in progress, machines, and mechanical construction dominate, and the culture in its classical form has become defunct. We are familiar with such sentiments from Wittgenstein's writings around 1931, exactly the time when he was reaching Spengler's decline. The affinities between the two are particularly evident from his 1931 sketch for a foreword. We may then imagine that Spengler helped Wittgenstein to see that his own earlier anti-historicism was itself a symptom of the fact that the West was now in a state of civilization in which its living culture had deteriorated into a catatonic condition, and that as a man without history, as which he had portrayed himself in his 1916 remark, he had unwittingly made himself part of that civilization from which he now felt so deeply alienated. There are additional lessons Wittgenstein may have learned from Spengler. Spengler had argued also that when we grow into a culture, we acquire our world picture not, quote, by definition or proof, but through, quote, feeling, experience, and intuition. He had spoken of world pictures as a mythology on which a culture is built, and here Wittgenstein appears to have taken him once again up when he wrote later on in Uncertainty that the propositions describing a world picture, quote, might be part of a kind of mythology. Yet there are also telling differences between Spengler's and Wittgenstein's notion of world pictures. Spengler assumes that every great culture has a fixed world picture that is created at the beginning of its history, which it then develops until it is exhausted, at which point the culture reaches a state of purely mechanical existence, and finally, one of inevitable decline, a condition called civilization. Wittgenstein was certainly in tune with Spengler's pessimism and his characterization of Western culture as having reached that state of civilization, but he spoke of world pictures in Uncertainty not as fixed, but as dynamic entities. Quote, the mythology may change back into a state of flux, he wrote famously. The riverbed of thought may shift. He set himself thus apart from Spengler's historical determinism and allowed for the possibility that, quote, this for culture and value, that perhaps one day this civilization will produce a culture. So just as culture has generated civilization as its end phase, civilization may one day also generate a culture. Instead of assuming the existence of discrete world pictures, Wittgenstein suggested that Spengler would have done better to have spoken of family resemblances within and between cultural epochs and periods. In his notes on Fraser, he described magical and scientific culture as being held together by different webs of family resemblances and thus clearly constituting different families. In reflecting thus on historical cultures, Wittgenstein rejected Fraser's attempt to think about culture as part of a continuous causal evolutionary chain. He accepted instead Spengler's morphological, or we might say typological, way of thinking, in which cultures have to be seen as distinct realities with their own internal formation. This becomes evident in Uncertainty with its preoccupation with the logical structure of world pictures, in which some elements are set to stand fast, to serve as axes or hinges around which other elements can turn. Interesting as this view is, it provides us, however, only with a limited picture of history, since it reveals nothing of the forces that drive the process of historical variation. A political history will, by contrast, be inevitably causal and genealogical in character. It needs to deal with how events bear causally on each other, how we have traveled on the road of cause and effect to the present moment, and what causal effects current events and happenings may have on the future. Part three is called the contingency of history. I turn now to a puzzle about time Russell first posed in The Analysis of Mind in 1922. That book is neglected these days, even though it is of considerable significance for Wittgenstein's thinking after 1930. So my picture is that we always say Wittgenstein was first influenced by Russell, and that was the result of the Tractatus. Then he returned to philosophy, and he had broken with Russell, and he turned to other matters. And I think that's wrong. He was certainly very much affected by Russell's thinking before 1914, and when he got back to Cambridge, he returned to Russell, and he took the Analysis of Mind deeply seriously, and we can't really understand what he was doing in the 1930s without reading that book. So, for instance, we always think what is new in Wittgenstein in this new period is the idea of language meaning is used. What we ought to realize is that this idea was not Wittgenstein's invention, but is there in The Analysis of Mind in 1922, except that Russell ultimately raises questions about it. He doesn't fully adopt this view, but he has the view. And I see what Wittgenstein is doing in connection with this question of meaning is used. He's really not inventing this idea, but he is trying to sort out the difficulties, overcome the difficulties that Russell had seen with this idea. So I think Analysis of Mind, absolutely. So here is Russell's paradox, and I quote Russell. There is no logical impossibility in the hypothesis that the world sprang into being 5 minutes ago. There is no logically necessary connection between events at different times. Therefore, nothing that is happening now or will happen in the future can disprove the hypothesis that the world began 5 minutes ago, end of quote. It is thus theoretically possible that the past has not existed. Russell goes on to say of this hypothesis that, quote, like all skeptical hypotheses, it is logically tenable but uninteresting. That was Russell. He is considering it only, quote, as a help in the analysis of what occurs when we remember. So memory, hypothesis important because it throws light on this question of the nature of memory. Consider then first, to expand Russell's words, that the world has existed over time, just as we commonly believe, and that as such it contains all the traces of the past on which we rely now to reconstruct its history. Consider next that our world has come into existence only a moment ago, right now, right, with all those apparent traces of the past. These would then be mere pseudo-traces, pseudo-relics, pseudo-fossils, pseudo-documents, pseudo-memories. But it would look exactly like the real historical traces in the first world. Would we be able to tell the difference between these two worlds? If not, why should we believe that the world has a history, has existed for a long time, and has not just come into existence with its pseudo-traces a moment ago? I want to call someone who denies that the world has a past at all a radical historical skeptic. There are obviously many variants on this case, since we may also assume that the world came to existence 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago, a year ago, 100 years ago, and so on. There are thus also many variations and degrees of historical skepticism. I want to ask here what light Russell's puzzle may throw on Wittgenstein's lack of concern with history as he has voiced it earlier in 1916. The puzzle brings out that all the evidence we have of the past derives from something that exists currently. We envisage the past as a temporal sequence, but are forced to determine the nature of that sequence by considering something that exists not as a temporal sequence, by considering a concurrent reality, such as a written document now before us, in which all the words are there on the paper at one and the same time. What we have as traces of the temporal historical process are things that have a concurrent reality. We could reconstruct the historical, in other words, from something that is not itself historical. And this might be taken to imply that historical knowledge is a derivative form of knowledge, and if philosophy is concerned with what is first and fundamental in human thought, as I think Wittgenstein certainly believes, then it will preoccupy itself not with history, but with how our current momentary reality can give us the idea of history. From this point of view, history itself may have no primary interest for the philosopher. So there may be no surprise in Wittgenstein asking earlier, what has history to do with me? I assume that Wittgenstein knew Russell's puzzle from the early 1930s onwards, but he discussed it at length only later in life. And so I want to say again, when we get to uncertainty, we always think uncertainty is this debate with Moore. What we never see is that, of course, the example, particularly these examples about the length of the existence of the world, is taken from Russell, that this is as much an engagement with Russell uncertainty as it is with Moore, right? So assume that Wittgenstein knew this one, but the first reference to this puzzle we find in part two of the Philosophical Investigations, where Wittgenstein writes, quote, that the sentence, the earth has existed for millions of years, makes clearer sense than the earth has existed for the last 5 minutes. For we do not know what observations the second sentence refers to, and what observations would count against it, whereas the first sentence belongs to a circle of ideas, Gedankenkreis, and observations that are familiar to us. Interesting as this remark is, Wittgenstein does not draw further conclusions from it in that passage. It's only in uncertainty that he takes up the issue more thoroughly, examining numerous variations of Russell's puzzle. Considering the possibility that someone may not believe that the Earth has existed 150 years ago, he comments, quote, it strikes me as if someone who doubts the existence of the Earth at that time is impugning the nature of all historical evidence. And now comes the amazing sentence, and I cannot say of the latter that it is definitely correct. I can't say of the historical evidence that it is definitely correct. The decisive point here is that historical evidence may convince us that the Earth has existed for a long time, but that this will not necessarily force the skeptic to agree, because he is always free to reinterpret the evidence. Wittgenstein continues this line of thought by adding, quote, I can imagine a man who had grown up in quite special circumstances and had been taught that the Earth came into being 50 years ago, and therefore believed this. We might instruct him, the Earth has one, and so on, and so on. We would then be trying to give him our picture of the world. This would happen through a kind of persuasion. So we can prove to someone who thinks that the world came to existence only moments ago, or to someone who thinks that in order to understand the world we need not speak in historical terms, that they are definitely mistaken. For we are facing here fundamentally different world pictures. Wittgenstein's conclusion is simple but disturbing. The difficulty is to realize the groundlessness of our believing. In the end, we can only say, I have some evidence, but it doesn't go very far. It is of a very scattered kind. I've heard, seen, and read various things. I conclude with a quick glance at the creationist debate, since it can throw further ray of light on the issues I'm concerned with. Creationism is of interest to me because it's not only a philosophical or religious doctrine, but also a political matter. In America, at least, where the issue is most hotly contended, the promotion of creationism is meant to serve as a tool, I want to say, as a weapon for undermining the long-established separation of church and state, with all the practical political consequences this implies. Creationism thus also illustrates the complexity of the relation between politics and history. It shows that various forms of historical skepticism can themselves acquire political meaning. The question the creationist poses is whether there can be conclusive evidence to disprove once and for all the claim that the world has come into existence only a few thousand years ago. Can the creationist not maintain his doctrine in the face of the entire geological and fossil records? Is it not possible for a god to have created the world a few millennia ago and for his own mysterious reasons with a spectacular array of pseudo traces? It should be evident that there is no way of disproving once and for all the creationist, and the same holds for any other form of historical skepticism. The creationist will be able to maintain his position in the face of all possible evidence. These considerations have philosophical consequences. They show that radical historicism and radical historical skepticism, indeed all forms of historical skepticism, are logically irrefutable. They show also that creationists cannot be refuted by logically compelling reasons. They show furthermore that anti-historicist forms of philosophical thinking, whatever their form and whatever their motivation, cannot be refuted. They also show, of course, that historical forms of thinking cannot be defeated by anti-historicism in any of its forms. We can be sure then that the long struggle between historical and anti-historical modes of thought in philosophy and elsewhere will continue. All we can do on behalf of a properly historical and historicist view of things is to marshal our facts in such a way that we can convince others that we have a comprehensive, coherent, and rich story to tell. They may or may not be persuaded by our endeavors. Wittgenstein understood this point. In Uncertainty, he commented on creationism, quote, "Very intelligent and well-educated people believe in the story of creation in the Bible, while others hold it as proven false, and the grounds of the latter are well known to the former, to the creationists. But these believers remain nonetheless unconvinced, not out of stubbornness, but because there can be no compelling argument to force either party to abandon the view. There are, however, considerations of the kind I've already mentioned that may undermine the creationist position. We can point out to the creationist, first of all, that the traces or pseudo-traces of the past contain reference to an apparent past, not maybe to a real one. Our memories or pseudo-memories are of events that appear to lie further back than the moment. There exist documents that speak of events 1,000 years ago. Some artifacts that surround us show signs of long-term deterioration. We discover fossils buried deeply under millions of Earth, and so on. When we assemble all these pieces of evidence, we can construct a coherent narrative of the past. We should be able then to get the creationists, and also the historical skeptics, to grant us at least that it is possible to construct a quasi-history of the world on the basis of those traces or pseudo-traces. The second consideration is that we as historians can tell a rich story of how the present has come about, and why the apparent traces of the past are real traces of a real past, whereas the creationist will have to refer to some mysterious event that would put everything in its place as we now have it, including all the things he considers to be pseudo-traces of the past that has never been. This consideration should help to weaken the creationist position, even though it cannot be logically refuted. The case reveals two fundamental points about our knowledge of history. First, that history is a domain where coherence is a decisive criterion, not perhaps of truth, but of the acceptability of our claim. The past no longer exists, and we can therefore not compare currently existing traces of the past with their past. A bare correspondence theory of truth is of no help here. History is also, second, a domain of knowledge where the existence of explanatory detail, the richness of our account, is a criterion of choosing between alternative narratives. Finally, in the last very short paragraph, I return to the point from which I started. My conclusion is that Spengler was right in thinking that we are only contingently historical beings. Both historical and historical forms of thought, and historical and historical ahistorical forms of life are available to us. And if it's correct that politics itself is in some way or other historical character, then we have one more reason for holding that our existence as political beings is also a contingent at historical facts about us. And with this, we are back to the question from which we started, the question what we might gain or what we might lose in choosing to be either historical and political beings or ahistorical and apolitical beings. Thank you.